Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Dacher Keltner is a psychologist who runs Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. And about 15 years ago, he and his students started to find awe in a laboratory. That's how he puts it in his latest book. It's called Awe, the book, and he explains how he and other scientists started tracking this emotion. They did these experiments with tears and with that sensation of feeling the chills. And they also collected stories. They had people keep journals and make notes, and they did a lot of interviews. And here's one of the questions they would ask in this, you know, this clinical setting. What is an experience of awe that you have had when you encountered a vast mystery that transcends your understanding of the world? Because it turns out everyone has an awe story. And Keltner says these narratives revealed really important things for the research. These images and metaphors that came up, you couldn't really get that in other experiments. And he has his own awe story about his brother, Rolf.
You know, he was a remarkable brother. And we had a remarkable brotherhood of, you know, being born in Mexico and growing up in the wild Laurel Canyon period of the late 60s and then moving to the country and, you know, fishing in our pond and building a tree fort and just wandering the hills. It was like this storybook type brotherhood. And we were close all the way through life. You know, we traveled together and we were best men at each other's weddings and taught together and backpacked together and the like. And then he got colon cancer. It is brutal and really painful. The abdomen is very painful and wild. So that was about 2 years of just, you know, following diagnoses and trying to help and visiting him and chemotherapy, and it looked good, and then the cancer returned to his gut. And when that happened, I knew he had a few months to live. This was at the end of 2 years of exhausting care and just watching him succumb to colon cancer. I couldn't comprehend it. And I was playing handball with Isaac, who's my longtime partner. And I get a text from my brother's wife, Kim, and she says, you know, he's taken the cocktail, which is this end-of-life cocktail, and you know, get your family and come. So I got my daughters and mom and we drove up and we all gathered around his bed. We all leaned in, we touched different parts of him. You know, I was touching his shoulder and leg and my mom was stroking his hair. And he was unconscious but smiling and his face looked calm and interested. I almost felt like he was leaning away from us and into something. And his breathing responded to our sentences. You know, we'd say, I love you, Rolf, and his breathing would slow. And I started to feel almost like an out-of-the-body experience or transcendent experience. And then as he really started to slow down, and I felt like I sensed space behind him, it was pulsating. I felt like there was almost some kind of spirit force pulling him away. I was beyond words, and then this voice in my mind said, I feel awe. And I started to grasp, wow, he's going. This is it. My mind was wildly open. It expanded physically. I started to ask these questions that I hadn't really asked with such intensity, like, what is life? Why does life end? Why do the people we love the most often die young? What in the world will my life be like without my brother Rolf? And then what happened after is, you know, we had a service for him, told stories, and, you know, I left, and, you know, I descended into almost a psychotic form of grief where I hallucinated and barely slept and was panicky and overheated and just my mind was confused. I was awless. Nothing felt wonderful. And that voice returned and said, go find awe. And I started to write the book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dacher Keltner is joining us today to talk about the science of awe. And he told us it was his upbringing that really prepared him for all of this, though he didn't grow up around scientists.
I grew up around a literature professor who was really interested in passion and romanticism and consciousness with Virginia Woolf. And my dad was this wild artist, and I grew up around rock and roll. But I was kind of a curmudgeon as a kid, I think. I was this grouchy little guy, and I wanted proof. I wanted to, you know, my parents still to this day have the wildest ideas. And I'm like, well, how can that be true? And, you know, I was always gathering data in a way and counting. I'm embarrassed to say, like, we went on this remarkable camping trip through Utah and Colorado in the late 60s. Spectacular camping trip. And I tallied up the fish that everybody caught just to make sure, like, how big they were. Like, killing everybody's joy. But, you know, I could tell you, like, who caught the most fish and whose stories were exaggerated. So I just had a mind that veered towards science and proof and rational analysis, if you will. And I have to say, Doug, to be absolutely honest, like, I was good at math and science. I was not a great fiction writer. I was good at biology. Mm-hmm. I was not a great artist. So I think that also contributed to the work that I do today, which is to really use science to be a part of a conversation around the human condition and the good life.
So we're going to dig into this in a moment. We'll get to a definition that you developed. But in basic terms, let's start there. What is awe?
There is no basic terms to define awe because it's ineffable and it's incomprehensible. And,
yeah.
You know, like when I was watching my brother pass, I'm like, what is all this stuff in my mind? But you know what? Awe is an emotion. It's a feeling state.
Yeah.
It has a feeling about the world. And it's brief, and it overcomes us when we encounter things in the world that are vast, or if you want to get a little bit more precise, that are beyond our current frame of reference or how we perceive the world, and that are mysterious, that transcend our understanding of the world. So when you see a remarkable lightning storm in the mountains of Utah, or when I watch my brother pass away, or you're moved by a passage of music, and you're like, God, where did time go when I listened to that music? Those are all vast, mysterious things that will lead people most of the time to feel awe.
When did you discover awe as, you know, as a thing, not just as a subject to study, but when did the idea of awe first start to occur to you? Can you
remember? Oh, yeah. You know, I remember. And this is a great thing for our listeners to just think about their early experiences of awe, because they're so revealing about your life and your family and where you live and your culture and your identity. And mine was in L.A., and I was on my way to the L.A. County Museum. My dad was taking me to an art museum, and my brother Rolf, and where we went a lot. But I was transfixed by the La Brea Tar Pits, which are nearby, which are these tar pits that have reconstructions of a woolly mammoth dying in the tar pit and a saber-toothed tiger ready to eat it. And I was just you know, they're vast and mysterious. I was like, whoa, look at these huge animals. What are they? And I, you know, it's interesting. I probably was four or five. I was just fascinated with dinosaurs after that and the earlier epochs of our Earth's evolution. And I was just like, oh my God, look at life. Like, look what life was like 70 million years ago. The shrimp were 6 feet long, you know? and so it opened my, it was really that first moment of like, oh my God, this is something I could think about forever. It's awesome.
And then let's fast forward to this conversation you write about in the book with a man named Paul Ekman, who you're 27 at the time. You're asking him, like, what's a good thing that I can study? And it comes up again, I guess.
Ekman has led an awesome life, you know, and I love him dearly to this day. He was the guy who did this facial expression research, you know, in New Guinea, yeah. and famous research, you know, novelists have written about it. The show Lie to Me is based on his career. You know, he's this kind of celebrity academic. And I had the chance, after some good fate, to interview for his lab. And, you know, and we talked, and then we went out on his deck in San Francisco. And, you know, I was fumbling along. And the science of emotion, which is so popular today, was just getting off the ground. Mm. We just didn't know that much. And he was one of the first. And I turned to him. I was like, well, you know, Dr. Ekman, like, you know, what should a young scholar study in this new field? And he looked out at this view. And I'm not sure if he realized how obvious this was, but he said, awe. And I, you know, I remember that. And I quickly went on to study embarrassment and shame and the emotions that were kind of more acceptable to study for a young scholar, and then eventually would find my way to awe.
So you write in the book about how you worked with your colleague and friend Jonathan Haidt to really articulate basically a definition of awe. Talk a little bit about, like, where you went looking, because you were looking at writings and you were exploring, like, peak experience. Like, where did you go searching to find this definition of awe?
You know, thank you for that question. You know, the definition of awe is the emotion you feel when you encounter vast mysteries. And that can account for, like, 90% of awe experiences. There are exceptions. But that definition really took a lot of work, and it really traces back to my collaboration with Jonathan Haidt, who's one of the most creative minds in the field. And it was an awesome experience to write that paper with him because, you know, psychological science just didn't, it just didn't fit in any theoretical framework. No one had really written about it. And so we're like, okay, what did other people say? And we consulted philosophy and Edmund Burke, his book from, I think, 1757 on awe, the sublime and beautiful. He said awe is about powerful, obscure things, vast mystery. John got me to read a lot of spiritual writings. There are great spiritual traditions, Julian of Norwich, the Bhagavad Gita, people writing about indigenous perspectives on, like, what is the mystical experience, William James. And it was interesting, Doug, because that writing, and it really guided the structure of the book. If you read these accounts of awe in spirituality or psychedelics, and also nature writings, which we read, it follows this structure of the experience of awe, of like, wow, it's vast, something's vast that hits me, it's mysterious. Your mind opens up and you explore, you're curious about things, you want to be good, right? So we just read for half a year all of this varying content, and we arrived at this definition of, like, awe happens when you encounter vast things that you need to shift your knowledge structures around. You don't understand them.
What is vastness?
Yeah, that gets, you know, then you always have to get more precise. And, you know, vastness very typically is size. So in the book, I write about hanging around the Golden State Warriors because I'm friends with their coaches. Or you could imagine the Utah Jazz. Those basketball players are awesome. Yeah. You know, when you stand next to them, it's like, they're seven. They're all big, really big. So vastness is size. It's also time. So often people, I ask this conductor, like, what's the secret to music in terms of awe? And he said, time. It transports you beyond your usual experience of time to vast projections of time. Like you'll be listening to the Beatles or, you know, a piece of classical music, and it'll transport you to your childhood. That journey is vast in time. And then interestingly, there are forms of awe that are vast in terms of knowledge, right? You can suddenly have an epiphany or an idea that unites a lot of ideas that you have and puts them into a structure. You know, I write about Darwin really discovering evolution throughout his voyages on the Beagle, but in this dreamlike state that he was in when he looked at this bank on a river and he saw all of this ecosystem in this process of natural selection. And it just hit him as a big idea. It was vast. It was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a big idea. It's vast.
Dacher Keltner. He's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. His book is called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Change Your Life. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Dacher Keltner. He's a professor at Berkeley, and he's devoted his career to mapping human emotions with science, trying to understand where emotions come from and how they work in our lives. His book is about the emotion of awe. Here's the definition he and his colleagues came up with after years of study. Awe is the feeling of being in the presence of something vast that transcends your current understanding of the world. In his book, he explains how awe brings us together with others. It syncs us up with people, and it syncs up the systems in our bodies. The book is called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. So I had this experience a few days ago. It was incredibly ordinary, which kind of gets to the point, which is I'd finished work, was walking out the building. There on the steps leading up to the building was a ladybug.
Yep.
And I love ladybugs, and I was worried about it getting stepped on. So I tried to sort of move it, and I did. I was able to put it in my hand. And I remember just sort of sitting there looking at it, and it made me that story came to mind because it was just it was a very ordinary moment. But that it seems like that is awe, and this idea of having awe in these ordinary moments is an important theme.
Oh my God! You know, there were just several discoveries along the way in the scholarship we did that made its way into the book that just totally surprised me, you know. And that's why we do science in some sense. And one was the concept of everyday awe. And we do this research, and we've done it in 12 to 15 countries, where at the end of the day, you get a little ping, and you are asked, hey, did you feel awe today? And if you did, please write about it. And we gathered those data, and we worked through them. And it turned out, in really different parts of the world, people feel awe, really remarkable forms of awe, like your ladybug experience, 2 to 3 times a week. And some people are feeling it every day. Some people, you know, several times a day. I think once you start thinking about awe and seeking it, you can really feel it almost any time. And that suddenly shifted my thinking about awe as, you know, there a lot of the thinking about awe is like these grand spiritual experiences, Paul on the road to Damascus, big nature experiences, right? John Muir. But actually, most of awe is just like your ladybug experience. It's things like, you know, this guy telling me this story recently of, you know, there was somebody on the train that he was riding who gave some money to somebody else. And he made eye contact with this person who gave money, and they literally were awestruck by eye contact, you know, and humanity. So yeah, Doug, like if there's one idea that I hope readers take from the book, it's think about everyday awe.
I love how you were doing this study about awe, and you turned it into kind of this, I think you described it as this taxonomy of awe. So we have these eight wonders of life. And I wanted to go through a few of these because I think they're so great. And you write about that for all of the people in all of the different cultures that you were asking questions of, that you were studying, you said most of these people were most likely to feel awe when they felt moved by moral beauty. That's the first wonder of life, moral beauty. What is moral beauty?
We're still figuring it out. Moral beauty is a way to summarize. It's a phrase to summarize, and you're catching all the novelties, thank you, of the book. Is, you know, not only is there everyday awe, but our most reliable source of awe is other people. Their kindness, their courage, soldiers writing about combat, a mom writing about her daughter with club feet who could dance, kindness, courage, wisdom, the ability to overcome obstacles, sense of justice, like people who really have a profound sense of justice, and you're near them, and you're like, man, this woman would give her life for this cause. And what's interesting about those is they move us like a good piece of music does. Which is, they make us tear up, they make us blush, they make us get goosebumps, they make us feel like the world is good. And that is a fascinating property of the human mind, that we have this deep aesthetic, emotional response to the goodness of other people. And it moves us to like-minded action.
There's this part of the book where you explore what you describe as this evolution of the soul, and how because you were referring to it there a moment ago, like, you know, tears and chills and woes. And I want to ask you about some of these. The tears, for example, turns out there are three varieties of tears. Talk about the obvious one, the tear of emotion, because this gets us to the vagus nerve. And because I just want to talk a little bit, start connecting this then to the way it works in our body.
Yeah, you know, beginning with William James, we've been really interested in how emotions are embodied. You know, blood pressure with anger and the heat of the blush during embarrassment and awe. You know, when we started gathering stories of awe, people would be like, oh God, my skin felt different and I got really quiet and I kind of teared up. And the tears come in all kinds of varieties, right? There are tears when your eyeball is scratched and when you have smoke and when you eat, when you encounter onions and so forth. But there is this tear of emotion. And it's interesting, we colloquially call it sadness, but it actually isn't sadness per se. There's a lot of nice research showing that it's really about when we see people coming together in community, we will tear up, right? When two strangers hug, or a child hugs their mom who's arrived at preschool, or two enemies suddenly embrace, we tear up. And it's this marker of connection, in a way, one of the physical markers of connection. And then lo and behold, the neuroanatomy gets really interesting, which is those tears are produced by a big branch of your nervous system called the parasympathetic autonomic nervous system and the vagus nerve, which acts upon the lacrimal glands to release these tears of connection or community. And that is striking because that branch of your nervous system is really different than the fight or flight system activated during fear. And it tells us, wow, awe is supported by this ancient physiology of calm and connection.
I think that was the most important insight for me, just that it's not just about ourselves, but awe is about the collective. And when tears, for example, one of the things you write about is, like, during political elections, we're moved to tears by the candidates who unite us, no matter where we come from. You know, like, we're just united by them. And so tears, as you say in the book, arise when we perceive things that unite us into community. Like, we are bound by tears as a community in some way.
I love that phrase, Doug, bound by tears. Yeah, you know, a deep story to awe is it really transitions us from our individual self and self-interest and competition and rising above others to collective. We feel awe about music that unites us with other people into community.
Yeah.
And those tears are a really vivid marker of like, hey, this is your community. This really matters to you. And it'll catch you off guard. You know, I go to UC Berkeley football games. We don't have a very good team. We don't win many games, regrettably. But when they play the Berkeley song after the rare victory, I tear up, you know, and it's irrational. It's like, it's a game, but it really is about my community. And I think, you know, that political election study is even more important, which is Hillary Clinton supporters teared up at her speeches. Donald Trump supporters teared up at his speeches. In the political times, we tear up at the speakers who represent our community. What an interesting way in which the body tells us about the soul, you know, and that's why I quote Walt Whitman, who loved community, because he said, hey, the soul is in the body. And here's a piece of evidence, like, here's a little reminder of like, this is where you can transcend yourself and be part of a collective.
Let's talk about the chills, because we get them, you know, we get the man that gave me the chill, dude, that gave me the chills. So, and you're talking about, you write about in the book, how scientists are actually kind of mapping the meaning of the chills. And here's one of my favorite parts of the book. You write about how our experience of awe are accompanied by goosebumps, but not cold shivers. So there's a difference. So break this down for us.
Again, this is why we do science, which is, you know, the you know, people will say, oh, like, oh, I get the chills when I feel awe. But I also get the chills when I saw Schindler's List and the images of the Holocaust, right? Or I saw images of the Rwandan genocide. And you're like, wait a minute, the same body response for the, you know, for horrifying things and awesome things? What gives? And, you know, scientists like Todd Thrash have done really careful work, and there are two varieties of chills. You know, one is the tingly stuff that goes up your back and your arms and your scalp. And those are little muscles that contract around hair follicles. And it's a parasympathetic autonomic response. And the other one, the shudder, and we call the first one goosebumps, the second one is a shudder, is where you kind of have these big muscle contractions and you shake and you shiver. And that's totally different anatomically. Those are big muscles that are moving the body. Evolutionarily, they both emerged amongst social mammals to fight off cold, which is a serious threat to survival. The chills, the fluffing of the fur and piloerection was about merging with others to stay warm when it got really cold. And the shudder is your last resort. It's like, I'm alone, it's really freezing, I'll shake my body to warm up the tissue. And interestingly, that deep mammalian evolution explains how the chills and the shudders really mean different things for humans. The chills are about awe, and Todd Thrash has shown when we get awe from music or a piece of visual design or spiritual experience or out in nature, that tends to be the piloerection, those goosebumps rushing up your back. And then when you're really horrified, you know, by 9/11, like, what is that? Or or a genocide or a horrifying murder, you get the shudder, right? And that's a really different response. It's interesting, that difference also manifests in different religious traditions where you see the chills being more prominent in certain kinds of traditions. So really interesting to do this kind of neurophysiology to understand the meaning of awe.
Well, it raises a question that you get to in the book also is our experience of awe, is it just our reaction to beauty? You know, is it different from our feelings of beauty? Is it just a more, as you say in the book, is it just more an intense feeling of beauty? And it's different, right?
It is. And, you know, when we figure out emotions like awe, we figure out what they do how they're different from other related states, like horror, in terms of the chills versus the shudders. And then beauty is a tough one. You know, I feel beauty in looking at the mountains in, you know, sunset in Utah, or the mountains, or a river. I feel beauty listening. Some music is beautiful. Faces are beautiful. Visual art, of course, is beautiful. An idea can be beautiful as well as awesome. So how do we parse these differences? That question is an old one. You know, Edmund Burke, Immanuel Kant, great 18th century philosophers really tried to parse them apart. And Burke said, who was so influential in thinking about awe for me, he said, you know, beauty, awe is more powerful. It's like, whoa, that was an awesome storm. Beauty is more affectionate. That was a beautiful rainstorm. And he left it at that. And then we did nice work that Alan Cowan did, who's a computational scientist. And what you do is you show people thousands of images and you have them rate them on a lot of different terms. And you use complicated statistics to parse out these emotions. And you can pull apart awe from beauty. And awe is vaster. It's wilder. It's more mysterious. You kind of feel like, I don't know what's going on here. Big flocks of birds flying in patterns, right? And then beauty is smaller scale. It's softer. You kind of know what's going on right away. Like I see when you see a flight of 20 pelicans kind of moving in unison across the horizon of an ocean, it's like, oh, that's beautiful, right? You know what's going on. It's smaller. And I hope our listeners, you know, kind of digest this, because one of the interesting things in talking about awe in so many contexts is people are like, you know, this science helps me really identify when I'm feeling this. Oh, I get the goosebumps. I tear up.
Yeah.
I say, wow. And it really is different from these more easygoing, affectionate, easily understood experiences of beauty. It's just powerful and wild and mysterious.
Dacher Keltner, his book is Awe, the New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Dacher Keltner. We're talking about his book, which is a kind of field guide for the what, the how, and the why of awe. Let's talk about the double rainbow guy.
Oh, man.
Paul Vasquez. Everyone will remember this. This was one of the first viral videos. I think so. I mean, from 2010, this delightful, delighted guy sees this double rainbow and he just doesn't know what to do with it. And he keeps saying, whoa,
that's so intense. Whoa, man. Wow. Whoa. Whoa. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Whoa.
You write about woes, how the woe we hear in that video was explained. I love this by Darwin in some way as a way to show how we alert others to the wonders of life. It's this thing known as a vocal burst. Talk about the woes.
Yeah, you know, most mammals, Darwin wrote, have these vocal bursts. Horses have different kinds of neighs, and cats, it turns out, have six kinds of calls. The sound of different species is there to communicate emotion, and as you nicely said, alert the individuals around you, like, hey, that's a dangerous animal, or this is really delicious, or watch out for that, or whoa, this is amazing, let's all revere it or take it in. So this is a old mammalian language that humans share to communicate to each other about our mental states, our feelings, and to prompt actions in others. And what's interesting about the sounds of awe, like wow, whoa, whoa, is their structure, their acoustic structure, which you can parse and analyze, actually looks a lot like certain kinds of sacred music, like choral music, will start to sound like the sounds of awe, right? And what that tells us is we start to share these sounds of awe to enter into the mental states of transcendent awe, right? Like, wow, the world is mysterious and vast.
When did we first start archiving awe?
You know, we have the hypothesis, the archive hypothesis, that one of the things, you know, there's this whole new thinking. It's so fascinating about cultural evolution. Culture is this incredible system of knowledge that we learn really quickly. And so, for example, you know, in the Arctic, people through culture and stories will learn how to find food sources much faster than they would learn by trial and error. So this remarkable knowledge that we store with each other and pass down. And we have these archives of emotions, because emotions are important to our individual and social survival, about what to fear and what we should get angry about and what is awe-inspiring. And that framework helps us start to understand how central awe is to culture and art and music and spirituality. And so, you know, the thinking is early instruments, 80,000 years old. Clearly, you know, there are new we have certain ways of singing to young children that are universal, that are much probably older, and that had awe in them, right? The early cave paintings, 40 to 50,000 years old, and probably we are decorating, beautifying shells. You know, you think about the patterns of jewelry and ancient people's old traditions. And a lot of it was about stirring awe and beauty in other people. Like, let's get together at a celebration and find awe. And lo and behold, you know, if a young person's out there listening, they're like, that's what I do at, you know, at a festival. So it's a way that culture brings the tools of awe together to make us feel collective.
So if a cave painting,
yeah,
or saying whoa is a way of saying, I get how it would work in evolution,
yeah,
as a warning. There's a saber-toothed tiger. Be careful. That's quicksand. Whatever.
Right.
But describing something more abstract as, look how cool this is.
Yeah.
Look how vast that is.
Yeah.
Like, how does that work in evolution? Why would that matter?
I think in some sense, what really matters in these cultural experiences of awe, like music and visual art and spiritual practice, what's critical here, critical to really human success, is our ability to share ideas and awareness of the context. And so these experiences of awe and woes and you know, stopping together to observe a vast storm, or sharing a moment at a political rally of, like, this is awe-inspiring what this person is talking about, the Martin Luther King speech, what that's doing functionally is it's uniting people to recognize this is important to our group. Right. And so music isn't random in its meaning. It is telling us, if you like punk rock, for example, it's like, this is about injustice. And, you know, yeah, and we all like thinking about injustice, if you like, or hip hop. So it not only functionally is helping us share an awareness together, which is important to collaboration, but it's also pointing us to, like, this is what we think is important to us as a people.
It made me think of how when you're at a football game and you do the wave with thousands of other people, that you're sharing this kind of biological rhythm. Like, there's this kind of, I think, you know, you sort of describe it as this kind of emotional contagion that's going on, that we're moving in unison.
Yeah. And it's so funny to me, you know, like how, and again, it speaks to how just sharing movement and then sharing awareness, like, hey, we're all moving together, you know, how transcendent it can quickly become, because, you know, you get people doing a folk dance and they're doing these movements together. And then at the end of the dance, they're like hugging and tearing up, like, that was fabulous.
Yeah. One of the things you write about is this concern that maybe we're not giving you know, children today enough opportunities to discover and experience awe.
Yeah.
There's this Rachel Carson essay that you mentioned that she wrote, Help Your Child to Wonder. This was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But you sort of tease out how great that was, how important that was. And I wanted you to say something about that because you also mentioned some ideas. Like, and I loved this one, trace an insect sound to its source. So we talk a little bit about this because that is your hope, is you want people to sort of work on this and find awe.
Yeah. There are a lot of ways to cultivate awe. You know, you can listen to awe-inspiring music and dance with people and go to a museum, go hiking in the mountains of Utah and, you know, elsewhere. And I had a lot of people ask about, you know, what's the mind of awe? Like, how do I find it mentally? And I started to explore sources, you know, like, how would I discover this? And I got to Rachel Carson, who's a hero of mine. You know, wrote Silent Spring, woke up America to, you know, environmental destruction, in this case, pharmaceuticals or pesticides. And she has this remarkable essay, Teach Your Child to Wonder, which is published in, I think, 1957 or 61 in Ladies' Home Companion. It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's in this hyper, you know, gender stereotype magazine. It's one of the most radical essays you'll read. And she says, like, our society takes awe away from kids. And you think about her society of the 1950s and that kind of monolithic culture, definitely. And Carson lays out, like, here's how you teach your child to wonder. You know, go wander, give them time, distrust immediate labels, you know. And I love, like, you take your child on a walk in the forest, and you're like, well, that's a cedar, and that's a pine tree. And they're like, Dad, you know, be quiet. And then yours is one of the most original, which is like listen to things, look at things, look at patterns of light, listen to sounds, and see where your attention focuses on, and then trace that sound, like an insect sound, to its source. That's an amazing intellectual exercise. Like, wow, look at what sound is, and then you can get philosophical, like, wow, source means, how did the insect produce this sound? You can do that with ocean waves or rainstorms. So that essay, to me, is a Bible of how to find awe as a mental state or philosophically, you know. Wander, give yourself time, go to mysterious places, distrust labels, and then trace your conscious experience of things to their origins and see what that tells you about what you're perceiving.
I want to come back to awe in death.
Yeah.
Because you write about the work of Roshi Joan Halifax, and she has this book that you mention, this kind of these principles of being with dying, being with the dying, and not knowing, and it gets to how awe fits in all of this. It's because it's about observation and wonder. And I wanted to come back to this because you mentioned how these ideas came to you in that last night of Rolf's life.
I am a hyper-rational person and a, you know, kind of a reductionist in ways. And my brother's death really challenged me. You know, like a lot of people who have loved ones who get cancers, you think you can analyze it and you think you can predict it, you know, and you think you can come up with solutions, right? I found this new therapy for it, or I'm doing research. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a year and a half, just reading latest studies and trying to figure out new approaches. You know, mistletoe, they use it in Germany, or saunas. Mm-hmm. And they actually work a little bit, you know, and that's how I approach it. But, you know, cancer, stage 4 colon cancer, stage 4 colon cancer.
Yeah.
It's going to take a body. And I really was struggling and really misfiring, you know, as a brother, like trying to control this experience. And I'm friends with Roshi Joan Halifax, who's this great Buddhist teacher and did a lot of work in hospice and wrote this book, Being with Dying, and I read it. And it changed my life, and it changed my life by changing how I was with my brother Rolf the last few months, where, you know, her principles are not knowing. You don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Science doesn't know how to beat cancer. How could I ever know that? We don't know what it's like. We don't know what his mind is like. We don't know what his death will be like. And so humbly grant that you don't know. And it was like, you're pulling such good threads together, because it's like teach your child to wonder, which is approach phenomena as mysteries, you know. And suddenly that changed my mind. And then the second principle was observe.
Yeah.
Don't direct. They don't want you to control or recommend things or present action plans. Observe with kindness. And that is like vastness. Like, you just open your mind and you're like, wow, this is just part of my brother's life. You know, we all end and we all die, and here is his. And those two keys, I would literally practice every day and every time I was with him. And it enabled me to have this transcendent experience watching him pass. You know, our culture struggles with being open to death. We don't have the rituals that other cultures do. We hide away from talking about it. And I had to really dig into these principles of Joan Halifax, of not knowing and being open, to starting to understand what this was all about.
Mm. You mentioned Virginia Woolf, who described these last flickerings of the innermost flame, and you sort of seeing that in your brother.
Yeah. You know, what a great phrase by Virginia Woolf, and that's probably what it is. You look at your loved one passing, and you're like, one of the questions, the mysteries you ask is like, what's in their mind? You know, especially when they're unconscious. And there were several times where the science of awe was a solace for me. It was a solace for me to know that death is a universal source of awe, you know, which we found in our research. It was a solace for me that our morality comes from the beauty of other people. And the near-death experience science, which I review in this book, was a solace to me that when people approach dying, you know, often it's horrifying and anxiety-producing and painful, but it's also transcendent, you know, and they feel like they're entering into a new transcendent dimension. And I felt that about my brother. You know, I just felt like that was his mind in that last flickerings of the inner flame of his mind. And it gave me enormous comfort.
You know, it seemed to me like, I mean, you refer to it toward the end of the book, this big idea of awe, that we are part of systems that are larger than the self. And that, I don't know, it kind of seemed like, to me, like the meaning of life, that through this, you know, epiphany of awe, we connect our individual selves to, you know, to the universe, to those vast forces of life. Maybe that's what it's all about.
Yeah, you know, there's a new emphasis in the science of happiness that I teach on meaning. Like, what is your real deep individual purpose in life, meaning? And our research really finds that when people experience awe, it is about meaning, their individual transcendent meaning that they give their life for. You know, you hear a piece of music that makes you cry. Why? Why that piece of music? And the science is suggesting there's something about the themes that it conveys about kindness or spirituality or love that really strike you, a personal chord in you. In my efforts to arrive at a thesis about that, I say, well, what awe does across these wonders of life is it locates you in these vast systems that define life and existence. Mm-hmm. That we are part of ecosystems, we're part of chemical systems, the solar system. The brain is a big, complex, you know, electrochemical system. Your body is a system, a heart's a system, your family, etc. And when you feel awe, it's saying, this is This is what I'm part of in life that transcends my individual self.
Diker Keltner, thank you very much.
Doug, thanks for the incredibly original and thoughtful questions. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Diker Keltner, he's the co-director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. His book is called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Change Your Life. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. We just ended our year-end fund drive, and I'll just mention that from now until the end of the year, the BW Bastion Foundation is doubling every donation made in support of Radio West up to $7,500. So if you haven't yet, you can give at radiowest.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.